Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Well, with every passing day, the number of people infected with COVID-19 reaches a new high. According to the Johns Hopkins Coronavirus Resource Center, 353,692 people have been infected globally. Here in the U.S., that number is now 35,345. The gravity of the situation is reflected in measures some of the hardest hit countries have adopted to try to reduce the infection rate. Italy has shut down the entire country. France has imposed a lockdown. When people leave their homes, they have to have a piece of paper telling authorities why they are out. In the United States, seven states have issued stay-at-home guidelines, including California, Illinois, Ohio, and New Jersey. With the pandemic sweeping the globe, China, Europe, and the United States are spending billions of dollars to fund research and development of vaccines and treatments to combat COVID-19. So how much will these treatments cost, and who will have access? Today, we're joined by Sharon Lerner, an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. Her work has also appeared in The New York Times, The Nation, and other publications. Hi, Sharon. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes, you're fine. Thank you so much. Sharon, before we dive in and talk about a vaccine, I want to talk a little bit about testing. The San Francisco Chronicle reports that testing in California has significantly expanded over the past week. But as you report, a lot of nurses are complaining that they cannot get tested. You just wrote a piece, gosh, March 18th, that healthcare workers fear that they are infecting the elderly. What are you hearing from frontline healthcare workers?
Well, March 18th also, feels like a century ago in COVID years, but I am still hearing that there is really a vast shortage, which is putting both healthcare workers and everyone else at risk. So in that piece, I was focusing on geriatricians, who, of course, are in a particularly perilous position. Because not only do they have to worry about themselves and their family members, because one thing to note, and we can come back to this, is healthcare workers in China, for instance, they, when they fell sick, were able to quarantine apart from their families. When we don't have that capability thus far in most parts of this country, or any really that I've heard of, which means that family members are very much at risk. But anyway, so with geriatricians, they have themselves and their families to worry about. And, of course, they're very, very delicate patients. And I spoke to a number of providers who work with these elderly, vulnerable patients who were not able to get tested, even when they suspected that they may have been exposed and been infected. So, that puts them in this spot. What do you do? Do you potentially expose your vulnerable patients or not? And more broadly, I can tell you my husband is actually a primary care doctor in one of the New York City hospitals. And what he's telling me, and actually this has been reported elsewhere, is that in New York City at this point, we're not testing anyone who isn't going to be hospitalized, basically, who isn't sick enough to be hospitalized. So if you're, even if you have what we now know are these telltale symptoms, the dry cough, a high fever, all these things, unless you're sick enough to be hospitalized, you're basically being sent home to quarantine by yourself, or in your home, probably not by yourself, actually, probably with family members who, again, will be very much exposed.
Wow. And since you brought up New York, Sharon, last night NBC reported that coronavirus deaths in New York jumped from 63 yesterday morning to 99 last night. So they're starting to see big jumps in just one day.
Yeah, it's quite scary.
And the other thing I wanted to mention, Sharon, is I've been in contact with a nurse in the East Bay. She says that she would love to write articles for newspapers, but she just doesn't have time. And so she's asking us to get the word out. And she just wrote me this morning, and she said, many nurses are sick and self-quarantining for safety's sake, which is further contributing to our staffing problems. The lack of equipment obviously is still a huge problem. She says, we've already run out of eye protections. We're reusing those now. N95 yeah. masks are scarce. Last night, we ran out of hand sanitizer and peroxide cleaning wipes. In triage, mm-hmm. she says, we wipe and clean our own beds and equipment.
Yep. Yeah, and we're hearing this from all over the country, right, that there are these shortages of very basic supplies, masks, gowns, et cetera. Yeah, and right, and so it's this problem that compounds itself, right, when healthcare workers are left exposed and then they become sick and then they can't deal with the surge of people who become sick. And that's what we knew was coming from, you know, reading reports from Italy and from China, and I believe we are now there as well. I mean, I don't think we're at the worst of it, but we've been hearing reports from all over the country that is the case.
Right. And the Surgeon General went on the Today Show this morning to say that this is going to be a pretty intense week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the thing is, it's not going to be better at the end of the week. I think we're in for several weeks at the very least of worsening. I mean, I think there are various estimates about when this is going to peak. I don't think anybody really knows quite yet. But in terms of increasing infections and increasing deaths and increasing shortages, I think that we're going to be heading up that curve for quite some time.
Right. And I also should mention, Sharon, the doctors and the nurses are doing amazing work in our hospitals. We should also mention the support staff, like the janitors, mm-hmm. the drivers, mm-hmm. Because NPR yes. ran a piece, it was 3 weeks ago, and a nurse at UCSF said, the drivers have not been trained. Our necks are exposed. Mm-hmm. Like there's right. so many other people that come into contact with the patients. And we also yeah. need to elevate their voices and talk about what protections they need.
Right. So, and I would add that I think you're absolutely right. So EMS workers who, you know, are doing this real frontline critical work and are not overseen by any federal authority or not protected, really. There's just an incredible range of variation in how well trained and how well paid and how well organized. Some areas of the country have volunteer EMS crews. And so, you know, all those folks are going to be heavily exposed. I know the frontline clerks, you know, administrative staff are in many of these hospitals are still, there for work. And I know that they are, at least I know firsthand that in many cases they're not well trained and are suffering from the same shortages that the docs are and the nurses.
Sharon Lerner is an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. And now I would like to welcome Gerald Posner to the show. Gerald is an award-winning journalist and New York Times bestselling author. His latest book is called Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Hi, Gerald. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks. So good to be with both of you.
Well, it's great to have you, Gerald. We were just talking about frontline healthcare workers, doctors, nurses, janitorial staff, the EMT workers, the drivers. And I want to ask you, it's related, but we'll get to pharma in a minute and a vaccine. Since you are in Florida, here in California, there were so many cases on social media over the weekend of a lot of people gathering in beaches, in parks, going to the getaways. A lot of small towns saw traffic that they just haven't seen in a long time. And I just want to ask you what it's like where you are in Florida, because again, over the weekend, we saw photos of people on beaches and on sailboats. And we did get word that 5 young people partying during spring break were tested positive for COVID-19 in Florida.
I mean, you know, it's one of the most infuriating things. What you have going on in California is mirrored here in South Florida, which is spring breakers arrived. They ignored all of the sort of exhortations from local governments, by the way, don't stay in groups, don't be over 50 at first from the CDC, and then not over 25, try not to be 10. We see the same images on the beach, which they've now closed in most of the east coast of Florida, and the images of partiers on boats. I saw it in Australia the other day. My wife is British, and her family reports that there were long lines in Scotland at a ski resort for people fleeing England that wanted to do something, and the town was saying, please don't come here. You're bringing the virus possibly into the town. We don't want it at this time. I think that one of the early messages that came out from the CDC and others, and it was too early because it turns out to be wrong, which is it gave the feeling of immunity to people in their 20s and 30s, saying, you know, it's only really a risk for the elderly. Yes, they're at highest risk, the elderly, no doubt about it. Those with health complications will have the highest percentage in the death rate, but young people not only can become infected and quite ill, as we know, the youngest here is 18, I think, in Florida, but in addition, you can be a super spreader. You can be somebody with very mild symptoms. You continue to go out and you socialize and you do things, and you're passing it along to those who are more vulnerable. So it's extremely irresponsible, but unfortunately not always surprising.
Right. And in fact, I just looked online, and according to WFLA, a TV station in Florida, it's actually six University of Tampa students who tested positive for the virus after spring break. So you have to wonder, you know, when did they get it? How did they get it? And how many other people were they in contact with before they tested positive?
Yeah, and this is the part, you know, I heard, you know, before Susan was saying the fact that she doesn't think that we've reached the height of this crisis. And that's absolutely right. There's no question about that with what Sharon said. I think that one of the things that people expect, and I hear this a lot from when I'm talking to people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, they say, oh, we'll be able to flatten the curve. And what the fallacy is about that is they think it's like a light switch. You either flatten the curve or you get overwhelmed with a peak. So we don't all have to be Italy. Maybe we'll be like South Korea. They don't get the difference that what it's likely to be, and Governor Cuomo's talked about this, is not so much one or the other, but a series of waves. And those waves will come at sometimes and almost threaten to overwhelm the system, the healthcare system, might occasionally, and then they'll go down, and then another wave will come. That's more of what we will probably see in the next couple, 2 to 3, 4 months, as opposed to either we're clear or we're not clear.
Right. Sharon, what about New York? What are you seeing? What are you hearing? Are people observing physical distancing? Are they staying home?
Well, yeah, so yesterday evening at around, I think it was at 8, the governor's new, I think he called it the pause, was, you know, instituted, which is essentially a shelter in place. People are supposed to stay home with the exception of exercising solo, you know, going to get food or going, you know, for medical care. And so today's rainy day here. I have not been out. I can see the streets are empty from my windows. Although over the weekend, I think it was very quiet from what I saw. But, you know, there were still sort of clumps of, again, I saw young people mostly who were, you know, in their 20s or teens who seemed to be slow in getting the message. Hopefully that'll be different this week.
And it's important to also still get the message out. Gerald just talked about this. We are now learning that young people are not immune from COVID-19.
Right.
The CDC says that, you know, people 20 to 50 are being hospitalized with this.
Right.
There's a famous DJ in New Orleans, and I'm going to grab his name. I have so many tabs open right now, but I will grab his name when I find it, who died this weekend.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe he was
yeah.
in his mid-40s. So it's important
yeah.
to get the word out about that.
Yep. And of course, we know that underlying conditions are part of that. You know, people who smoke seem to be at particular risk. I wrote a piece last week, I guess, that was in part based on some Italian healthcare experts who were saying that folks who live in areas with high air pollution are likely to be most vulnerable, which of course is a lot of our country. There are a lot of ways that people can be particularly vulnerable, but I think, you know, the message is really that we all are.
And on top of what Sharon just said, only after this pandemic is over will we be able to look back and know exactly what the higher risk were that we're unaware of right now. What I mean by that is mm-hmm. there is already a study out on March 11th from a group of scientists talking about whether tens of millions of people who take prescription drugs for hypertension or for diabetes right. may be at a higher increased risk of COVID-19 infection. There's some anecdotal information about that. They're looking into it. We'll know the answer to that 6 months down the road. But right now, you may not even need, in all cases, an underlying condition. You may be taking a prescription drug that will make the virus more accessible to your system. There's nothing to do about that, but that's unfortunately the nature of a novel virus.
Well, I did find the name of the DJ. He's born Oliver Stokes Jr., and he went by the name Black and Mild. He was a radio personality in New Orleans, sadly died on Thursday. He was only 44 years old. Gerald, before we move on and talk about a vaccine, can you just again reiterate the importance that we are still learning, and we do know that people 20 to 50 are not immune from this?
No, absolutely. And I think what has also happened is the good and bad news. So the good news is this is the first pandemic ever in the era of social media. And we hear information that's good and sometimes false, and rumors are passed along. But we're getting an overload, not an overload, but a tsunami of information is coming in every day for those of us who are following it. The bad news is that we're also learning about the shortfalls of the system as they happen, as you were talking about with Sharon before, in terms of the way the testing's being done and the healthcare risk to those who work at the medical facilities. And so that takes away, adds to the panic and a little bit of the anxiety that people have overall. But I think that the hardest message to get over is not just saying, as I do often or as others do, it's a risk to you if you are in your teens or 20s. You are capable not only of getting this, but it can be a very dangerous illness depending on how it comes into you. People think that it's being overstated. And I even see that people in their 40s and 50s who think, it's just the influenza, it's just the flu on steroids. I can get really sick, but I'll be fine. And not only is that not true if you happen to be young, but in addition, there has to be some sense that we are all in this together. And this social responsibility, which is necessary to stop microbes like this from really killing a lot of people, is making sure that you do your bit by actually not going out and putting others at risk. So even if you happen to be fine with it and you recover from it, you just don't put others who may be really susceptible to it at a greater risk. And I think that's a necessity.
Mm. Well, today we are joined by Gerald Posner, an award-winning journalist, author of a new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Sharon Lerner is an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. We are going to talk about a potential vaccine and other treatments, but I do want to share some breaking news with everyone. Carrie Levine, who is a reporter with the Center for Public Integrity, just tweeted that Senator Amy Klobuchar just announced that her husband is hospitalized with coronavirus, and she was on a press call to discuss vote-by-mail legislation, and is starting off by reiterating that many people are going through similar strains right now and unable to be with their loved ones. Sharon, I was reading a doctor's article a couple weeks ago who said that politicians are going to get this within the next couple of weeks, and we're already seeing that start to happen, and their families.
Oh, yeah, right. We're seeing that for sure. Rand Paul, I know, and a couple of members of Congress, and we have seen this, and all the folks who were, not all the, many folks were exposed at CPAC from the Trump administration. But it's of course because it's throughout all of us, right? And so these are the visible sliver, the very public folks where we can see this mirrored as it moves through the entire population. I guess it's just a reminder, we of course want no one to suffer from this, and it is, the only silver lining is that it is now, it's visible to those people who have been slow to appreciate the seriousness of this, as Gerald was mentioning.
I'm sorry, I was just going to add one thing, by the way. When we think about Congress, the 535 members have an average age of 60. So if you talk about a group of people at risk, I go out into the population, I grab 535 people, and then I determine their average age is 60. I'm going to say that's an at-risk population. And you would think that they would finally amend the rules so they can do what they're telling the rest of America to do, which is work from home or vote virtually. It's madness to look at Congress still have this antiquated rule that you have to be on the floor in order to vote. In this day and age and with this pandemic, they should be leading by changing that rule.
Well, and Senator Rand Paul tested positive, and CNN reported that just yesterday morning, before they got word that he was positive, he was with a number of Republican senators talking about the bill. He also went to the Senate gym yesterday morning, and a lot of people said, why is the Senate gym still open?
Right.
It's a good question.
Right.
And also, I mean, you know, to note, you know, the age of the both Democratic candidates, both of who were, you know, whom are men, it's like, it just is very, this is a vulnerable population, our folks in D.C.
Right. And so now we know that Senators Mike Lee and Mitt Romney are going to self-quarantine. So again, that brings up a question that you just raised, Gerald. How are these people going to vote?
You know, it's interesting because this has been discussed a little bit. I know that California Congressman Eric Swalwell had an idea. He introduced a resolution recently, and he had a co-sponsor with his Arkansas representative on the other side of the aisle that would allow members to sort of have this participation virtually in hearings and vote remotely in special circumstances. Not saying we're going to change the rules forever, because all those people up on the Hill love their tradition. I understand that. But they need to update it for something like this. We're in a once-in-a-generation pandemic. And if they can't modify the rules at this point and do it quickly, then something's really wrong with Congress and that operation.
Well, and people are tweeting right now, they are on the floor and they're not practicing physical distancing.
Wow. I mean, isn't it astonishing? One of the things that is astonishing is that when I watch the press conferences during the afternoon that are held by the Trump administration, I can't believe that that whether it's Dr. Fauci or Trump or Pence or whoever else, they're all crammed together. They're standing right next to each other. I turn on BBC or Sky News to watch Boris Johnson and his health ministers. There are three podiums that are like 5 or 6 feet apart. Is it going to work for Johnson and the rest not to keep them from getting infected? I have no idea, but I know at least it sends the message to the public, social distancing. You turn on the administration's briefings and they're huddled together. They're doing exactly what they tell us not to do, so it's not a very good example.
Right. Well, go ahead, Sharon.
I was just going to say it's hard to imagine that Dr. Fauci has not brought that up. If anyone understands that, it's him.
That's true. It is. He must have been overruled 100 times, but I'm not sure.
This is my guess. But anyway, no time for guesses. Go ahead, Rose.
No, this is really important. I mean, Dr. Fauci was interviewed by Science Magazine, and the reporter asked him, you know, what about these briefings? And he was talking about Donald Trump, and Fauci said, I cannot jump in front of the microphone and push him down. He said, let's get mm-hmm. real. What do you want me to do? So
I have to say, watching, I was watching the House Oversight Committee. I wrote about it, maybe it was on the 12th, it looks like. And it was, and he spoke at it. And, you know, it is, he's nothing less than masterful when it comes to walking this tightrope that he is on, which is he absolutely needs to stay where he is. Which is in a position where he can convey all that he knows with authority to the public. And, of course, we all know how completely volatile Trump is, how many people he's fired, you know, for nothing or for, you know, for standing up to him. And so even at that hearing, you heard him say, someone asked him whether it was a mistake that the Trump administration had dismantled parts of the National Security Council that were dealing with the public health threats, such as pandemics. And, you know, he paused for a moment and he said, not a mistake exactly, but he ended up saying it would be nice if the office was still there. I thought it was beautiful.
And he is fantastic because, you know, I write about him from his time that he was on AIDS, on HIV, working as mm-hmm. sort of the overseer with this. You have to remember, this is a survivor at a high medical position of the Reagan administration, both Bushes, Clinton, Obama, and now here under Trump. So he's very adept, not only with his science ability and fantastic at what he does, but he's adept politically to maneuver so that he doesn't fall on the wrong side of somebody's chopping axe when they want to clean out a department. And so he, as much as he, his veteran sort of ability through all these administrations teaches him how not to step on the landmine that might be the end for him.
Well, he told Science, when you're dealing with the White House, sometimes you have to say things 1, 2, 3, 4 times, and then it happens. So I'm going to keep pushing. Well, we're going to take a quick break. Today, we're joined by Sharon Lerner, an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. Gerald Posner is an award-winning journalist and author of the brand new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. This is Your Call. Coming up, we will get to our topic of the day. There are so many moving parts, and we just wanted to bring you the latest news. But we will talk now about efforts to create a vaccine and other treatments to deal with COVID-19. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. China, Europe, and the United States are spending billions of dollars to fund research and development to come up with a vaccine and other treatments to combat COVID-19. How much will these treatments cost, and who will have access? Today, we're joined by Gerald Posner, award-winning journalist and author of the new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Sharon Lerner is an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. We're getting a lot of calls, just general questions about, you know, social distancing, spending time outside. We will get to those at the end of the show. But right now, if you have any specific questions about treatments, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Sharon, there are a lot of moving parts with various pieces of legislation. At this point, how much money has been set aside specifically for vaccines and treatments?
I don't know that total. I know that the aid package that passed not so long ago was $8.3 billion. There's obviously more money coming. Mm-hmm. And then, Gerald, do you know the total?
Yeah, you're right, Sharon. It's $3 billion was out of that first $8.3 billion, but that's going to cover not just vaccines. It's also going to cover sort of what I call that crash work on trying to adapt an existing antiviral medication that some company has, maybe pairing it with one from another company. You know, they're doing test trials now. And so it's both for treatment, antivirals, and vaccine as well. So at least $3 billion. And remember, we've spent $700 million in the last just 10 years, NIH money, on coronavirus research because of SARS and MERS. So that's on top of what's already being given now in the new emergency funding.
Gerald, can you explain how this money is distributed? How are the decisions made behind the scenes?
Well, you know, that's one of the best things we have, I think, on the system now is exactly investigative reporters like Sharon Lerner who are going to keep the magnifying glass on how the money is distributed, because it's not going to be given just to anybody that comes along. You have to be one of the biotech or larger pharma firms that has already either a product or an idea that's fairly far along, and you can point to it and say, look, this antiviral now works for malarial or rheumatoid arthritis, and we believe with these modifications, because we've been looking at coronavirus, it can be adapted to stop, in the most serious cases, to stop the disease from killing someone, or in other instances in which they have a vaccine further along, they will be getting some funding to move along and push that. And I think, look, there's money that's going to be distributed here to test makers who come out with fast tests and get it on the market and can distribute it fast. There's going to be material also that some of that money will go for protection for healthcare workers and others. So we're going to see it spread around. What Washington does when it's in an emergency, it did it after 9/11, it's certainly doing it now, is it throws money at the problem, and some of it's going to get wasted, and hopefully some of it will actually turn out to be useful.
Sharon, can you talk about what it is like to follow the money, to find out how this money is distributed, who gets it, and how it's spent?
Yeah, well, you know, we are all like diving in as quickly as we can. I can tell you I'm beginning to, we were all working on totally different things just, you know, 2 weeks ago even. But so far I can tell you that I have been looking at the grants through a division of HHS called BARDA. So far, they've I've looked at 11 grants that they have given, you know, for COVID specifically to companies, including Mesa Biotech, Janssen, Regeneron, Diasorin Molecular. These are big companies, and they're mostly for tests and treatments and vaccines, as you would expect. I mean, the worrisome thing, of course, you know, with the test, we need tests yesterday, you know, and we are talking about, you know, some of it is about accelerating the development of things that were underway, but some of it, it is clear that a lot of this is really quite far away. They're just putting out, you know, giving them money now, and a lot of this involves tests, and as we've said, Dr. Fauci, you know, the voice of reason has been trying to convey that, you know, minimum a year at least when it comes to a vaccine will be necessary. One of the first pieces, the first piece I did on coronavirus was looking at some of the contracts that had been awarded through BARDA and other divisions of the federal government. And, you know, it's the thing that is striking to me so far is how behind the eight ball we are. So, you know, I wrote about, for instance, a contract, or it wasn't even a contract. It was sort of like an announcement of, you know, that they would be awarding a contract for 500 million face masks. And, you know, that was, they put that out, and this was in early March, and, you know, it was like bids due in 2 weeks, and then, you know, it was far, far off when it came to when those would be delivered. And, of course, again, we need those. We already need them. We need them right now. And we're hearing about people who, healthcare workers who are, you know, reusing masks, and, you know, people making masks out of bras and all sorts of nonsense. And of course, what anyone can see is that it's too late to do this. It's not too late in that we're going to need what is gets made, but, you know, boy, we all wish this had been done much sooner.
Right. Go ahead, Gerald.
No, I was just going to say, and you know, we're learning the lessons as we go along. Unfortunately, it's hard to learn the lessons because it means that we understand now why some of these risks have increased. That when Sharon's talking about the importance of testing, it was the CDC, which generally does a great job, that ignored. Actually, they turned away the World Health Organization's test guidelines. Those test guidelines, mm-hmm. which the WHO had developed very, very fast, based upon what was happening in China, were used by South Korea to develop their fast testing that were doing 10,000 people a day. Instead, the CDC decided to go ahead and come up with a more complicated test of its own that could identify sort of a range of similar viruses. That was the test that failed when it went out because it came up with too many, you know, false positives and had to be reworked. So it slowed the process up at just the wrong time.
The other thing is, you know, how much is this going to cost and who will have access? And Gerald, you've been saying that we need to demand pharmaceutical companies put aside the profit motive and contribute whatever they can to make sure this is stopped. I mean, how do we do this? You know, as Sharon reports, the ability to make money off of pharmaceuticals is uniquely large in the United States. There's a lack of basic price controls that other countries have here.
I'm flabbergasted that we are the only country on the planet that allows drug companies unfettered power to set their own pricing. It doesn't happen anywhere else. And the idea that we allow it to happen, no wonder they make most of their profits in the United States. No wonder drugs in the U.S., the very same drug that's sold in Britain, France, or in Japan or Australia, cost 2 to 4 times more than it does anywhere else. Because since they aren't limited, they get away with whatever the maximum is. And now we're talking about an epidemic, a pandemic, in which literally we are waiting for them to come up with a vaccine as fast as possible. That vaccine will save lives in the long run. And the question, the profit motive, why would, I've had some people say to me, well, why are you already raising that fear? Because we don't know if pharma will ask money. What we do know, not only is it in their DNA, not only have they done it in every other pandemic, they did it in 1976 when we were facing swine flu by withholding 100 million doses of the vaccine until they were given a reasonable profit by the government. They took 43 years to develop the vaccine for Ebola because there wasn't enough money in it originally. I know some of those firms had walked away. HIV, we're still waiting for a vaccine to come out, although there are drugs that people have made billions, Gilead and others, from drugs to treat it. The real question is, in the $8.3 billion emergency funding recently that the government passed, pharma lobbyists, and Sharon reported on this, were able to take out clauses that would have given the government more power to control prices if those prices were too high to make it affordable for most people. And I've always asked the question here, I keep asking it, it doesn't seem to be very popular, and that is, why don't lawmakers, Republicans and Democrats, consider the possibility of this, of a statute that's available that I call eminent domain for drugs? It allows the government to seize the patent of a company if it's for the public good, to make it available at a generic or government production at a fair price. That threat alone could bring prices down. It was used in the 60s and 70s, but isn't even on the radar right now for discussion.
Sharon, you wrote about this. Can you give us some context here? What was actually put in this bill?
Yeah, and of course, Gerald's new book is great context. That is exactly what his book is. But what, you know, Gerald mentioned that there is this incredibly long history of profiteering, and he mentioned this company Gilead, right? Gilead is actually in the midst of trials, I guess, and correct me if I'm wrong, if I get this wrong, Gerald, but basically for an antiviral drug. It's important to know that Joe Grogan was the top lobbyist for this company, Gilead, and he is one of the members of this White House task force on coronavirus. Alex Azar, of course, the head of HHS, is also a former lobbyist for a big drug company, Eli Lilly. And while that doesn't necessarily mean that they're out there to gain from this, this is how personally or for their companies, the companies that they did work for, this was their orientation until serving in the federal government, right? And so you want to make sure that at the very least, that orientation, which is from making, serving the boards and the profitability of these companies, it shifts. Well, how are we going to make sure that that happens? We need, at the very least, or one of the things we need is transparency about what's happening in these meetings, right? For instance, in the task force meetings, where we're going to have decisions about who gets what contracts. And you want to make sure, of course, at this point, we are looking to the private sector for help with this. But we want to make sure that the decisions about who is getting these contracts, these decisions are made based on who is best able to help, right? And they're getting, and that they're proceeding with the public interest in mind, and really only the public interest in mind right now. And, of course, I think that what Gerald's book, which again is this really in-depth look at the history of the pharmaceutical industry leading up to this point, what it shows us is that we unfortunately can't assume that that is how the pharmaceutical industry is approaching this issue. And I think he's right when he says, I worried about that too, putting out a story about pharma profiteering, when of course our first issue, everyone, is public safety right now, and I feel that very strongly. At the same time, the reason it's not too soon, as he said, is because it wasn't too soon for the industry. They already got in there. They had lobbyists in there and making sure that the bill was oriented in a way that would allow them to profit maximally. And so we need to deal with this now before it's too late. One more thing, Gerald. This is also a public health problem because ultimately we have a limited budget, and if we're spending 68% already of our healthcare dollars on pharmaceuticals because in large part of price gouging, we have to make sure that we don't, you know, we obviously desperately need healthcare funding because we're strained in every way. Mm-hmm. It's not the most equitable, or, you know, it's going to be a public health issue if we can't afford other things.
Yeah, but Sharon says it's so important. I think, you know, none of us are sane that the first priority is not getting a vaccine and focusing on drugs for treatment. That has to be the first priority without a question. But we can chew gum and walk at the same time, meaning there's no reason why our public officials cannot keep an eye on what's coming up in terms of the vaccine and the future pricing, because otherwise all the leverage goes to the drug company. And one last thing on Gilead, which was mentioned, is a perfect example of what takes place. They have a pre-exposure prophylaxis that is used widely. It's one of the most popular drugs to sort of prevent, hopefully, HIV infection. That was done by the CDC in 2006. Gilead had a patent on it, but all the work, the 2 years of work, it was taxpayer money. A San Francisco AIDS researcher was conducting parallel research with $50 million in federal grants, and the NIH-sponsored double-blind, placebo-controlled human clinical trials. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation had paid toward that. And the U.S. government patented that drug for prophylactic use for Truvada in 2015. Gilead sued to block it. The courts upheld it for Gilead, which then marketed to patients about $2,000 a month. They've brought in $30 billion since they put it on the market. The patent doesn't expire until 2021. If we allow, even in HIV and AIDS, in which there are activist groups to try to prevent this, drug companies from gouging on prices when it's really for the public benefit, then what's to say it's not going to happen again on this? And I don't find anything in drug history or in their DNA that gives me hope.
Well, this is concerning, Gerald, because as Sharon reported back on February 29th, her piece called Cronyism and Conflicts of Interest in Trump's Coronavirus Task Force, I mean, she leads with Alex Azar, Secretary of Health and Human Services, who served as a top lobbyist for Eli Lilly before becoming president of the drug company's U.S. operations in 2012, saying that a vaccine for the new virus might not be affordable for all Americans. And after he received a lot of criticism from Democrats, he walked the comment back the very next day, saying he would ensure public access to a vaccine. So as we know, so many people are uninsured, underinsured. Now people are losing their jobs where they had their health insurance. So people think when they hear the Secretary of Health saying this?
They should be enraged, or at least I'm enraged. And I don't get that easily enraged, believe it or not, but I do on this case. And look, everybody is making a sacrifice in this country. People who are working at restaurants serving tables, and people on construction crews, and individuals in the, you know, the airline industry and in the cruise ship industry, from the reservation taker to the people who are working on ships, are out of work and wondering where their next bill is coming from. People with who have children in school who suddenly have them home now and they don't have the money to have somebody take care of them. There's no daycare and they're worrying about the food to feed them. We're all tightening our belts and wondering about what the future holds. This is time for the pharmaceutical industry to do something for the public good for once. You know what? They want to make a profit. Great. It's a capitalist country. They're entitled to do it. They do make a good profit. But for once, maybe they can say, this research, will share it with everybody else. The breakthroughs we'll make will not be intellectual property that we patent, but it'll be available around the group. There's a precedent for this. It happened in World War II with the production of penicillin. And they shared that research. There was no patent on it. And afterwards, they made plenty of money afterwards. So if they can come up with a vaccine for literally this pandemic, and if they showed a little bit of public service for the public health, maybe they can go on and earn billions afterwards on all types of different medications for chronic conditions, but they'll have done the right thing now.
Gerald Posner is an award-winning journalist, author of a new book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. And Gerald, in the coming weeks or maybe even months, not sure yet, we will definitely have you back to talk about your book. Sharon Lerner is an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. And if you have any questions about vaccines, treatments, we'd love to hear from you. We're almost out of time. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. So, Gerald, since we are about a year out, it seems like the demands need to be heard now, that this drug, the treatments, these companies need to put aside the profit motive. What is the most effective way of citizens raising their voice to get that message across?
I really do think it is directed toward public officials. I mean, they need to hear it. And the reason I say that is very, very important. You know, in I sort of have a view that it's a pox on both your houses. When I say both your houses, I'm talking Republicans and Democrats. And sure, I can. We have a Republican administration in power now, and so it takes most of the blame that I throw out there because they're responsible for these shortfalls time and time again. But in the past, Democratic administrations have also taken pharma too much lobbying money from pharma and have given in a number of times to things that they shouldn't have. So my view on this is you've got to keep your public officials informed that you want them to get a fix. You want them also at the same time to provide it to people who don't have the money to be first in line, who aren't celebrities or multimillionaires, who are able to get a test when no one else can. But you also want to make sure that they're doing their part to make sure pharmaceutical companies don't become rich. We don't want executives with $100 million salaries going out to their third home and buying back shares of the stock so the stock price can go up for shareholders at the cost of people getting well in this country.
Sharon, what would you add?
Hear, hear, I would say. I would say that the walking and chewing gum point that Gerald makes, we need to be doing both and this is part of emergency planning, is making sure that as we take these very critical steps to ensure that everybody gets the treatments and vaccines that we all need, that we make sure that, you know, that we underscore everyone, right? So, and I do think that we have to look at history here, and we have to anyone who says we're being cynical by discussing this, I think is wrong. I think we need to look at it as we, you know, jump into action on all fronts. One of the fronts has to be making sure that we protect everyone by protecting ourselves against price gouging.
Final thoughts before we ask you both a few basic questions that are coming in from callers. Final thoughts on this, Gerald. I'm just trying to envision, once we come up with a vaccine or any sort of treatment, how it's going to be rolled out, given that, let me just look at Johns Hopkins, the latest numbers, 353,692 cases all over the world.
Yeah, I mean, what they will do, and it's used the they in a broad sense, I mean, governments in general, will, by the time a vaccine's ready, year to year and a half minimum, that would be a speed record, they will have identified and they'll know the groups most at risk, so those will be the ones prioritized, probably the elderly and those with underlying health conditions, but they will take them. If it turns out to be there's an unusual group in their 20s or 30s who have a particular condition and they're at risk, they'll also be on the priority list. The thing is that vaccine will be free for the government. But the government will have paid for it. And, you know, people say, well, if I'm going to get it free, why do I worry about what the government paid for it? But it's what Sharon said before, because there's only a limited amount in this pot, and it pays for everything else, from testing to the supplies needed by emergency and healthcare workers down the line. So that's why it's important to make sure it's at a fair price.
Well, I wanted to ask you both, we're getting a lot of calls from listeners who are very concerned because they're out and about and people are not keeping their 6-foot physical distancing. Sharon, thoughts on this? We kind of started talking about this, but we're getting a lot of calls now.
Yeah, you know, two things. One, it is important, and I experienced the same thing in New York. You know, you find a way. What I've been doing is, like, I really just walk off to the side and let people pass. And sometimes I've said it, you know, please keep your distance. The other thing is that I really recommend a piece that was it's on the New Yorker website by Tul Gawande about protecting healthcare workers, that goes into some incredibly helpful specifics about exactly how the virus passes. I found it really reassuring. And one of the things, you know, it says most of the transmissions are happening with close contact. So if you are standing 6 feet from someone who is not coughing and you're there for, you know, 10 seconds, and even if you're 5 feet and, you know, you're probably going to be okay. But I don't know. I just recommend that. But yes, it's to be taken seriously, and I hear you. And I guess I would say just don't go out as much as you can avoid it. You know, stay home.
Gerald, what would you add?
I've seen that some stores in as far away England, Norway, even some in the United States that are open places for supermarkets or pharmacies, the employees there have actually marked out every 6 feet apart with just masking tape or color tape where people should stand. And that is just a visual indication. It makes you realize how far away it is. And one easy thing is, if you extend your arm as far as you can, as if you were taking a selfie, take your cell phone, extend it as far as you can, double that. And that's the distance you should have. So there's some easy ways to try to remember it. It's hard to do, but I agree with Sharon. I've also sort of moved away from somebody when they're too close, but we can do it. This is not a time to be shy and try not to hurt somebody's feelings by speaking up. You need to do it.
Gerald Posner is an award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author. His new book is Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Gerald, thank you so much for joining us, and we will definitely have you back to talk about your book.
Thanks so much. I hope that we have slightly better news the next time we talk.
Yes, I hope so. Thank you so much. Take good care. Sharon Lerner is an award-winning health and environment reporter for The Intercept. Sharon, thank you so much, and we're going to follow you and all of your reporting, and we'd love to have you back soon.
Thank you. Good to talk with you, Rose. Be well.
Thank you so much. You too. And thanks to your husband for his important work. The story that Sharon cited from The New Yorker by Dr. Atul Gawande is called Keeping the Coronavirus from Infecting Healthcare Workers, What Singapore's and Hong Kong's Success is Teaching Us About the Pandemic. That is one show idea that we will definitely do in the coming weeks. What can we learn from other countries who have been dealing with this longer than we have? If you have any show ideas, guest ideas, if you're a worker on the front lines and you want to speak anonymously, if you want us to get the message across, please email yourcall@kalw.org. We are hearing from nurses, ride-hailing drivers, and others, and we definitely want to get your voice on the air, so please email us. You can always remain anonymous. yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Damian Miner for running the board. Kevin Vance is there answering the phones. Thank you guys so much. And we are practicing physical distancing, so we are all spread out in distant places. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.